Our guest this week is a rising star in the talk radio world. Since April of this year, she's been the co-host with veteran broadcaster Bo Thompson of The Morning Show on Heritage Station WBT in Charlotte. Since joining the station a mere 5 months ago, the program has risen to the top of that important radio market's ratings, and there's a buzz going on around the industry about this woman's obvious talents. Full disclosure, at the time I recorded this interview with her last week, I hadn't yet heard her show on the air, something for me that's quite rare. I went into it based on how highly recommended she was and her very interesting background, figuring I'd check out her work after the fact. I've subsequently done that and was not at all disappointed. She even exceeded expectations. WBT has a morning show in place worthy of the national radio industry's attention. Our guest, though still a young woman, has led a fascinating life and brings her experiences and her infectious positivity to the airwaves. She's a Charlotte area native and a UNC Chapel Hill graduate. One of her first media jobs was working on the production team for the Smash TV series The West Wing. She ran for U.S. Congress at age 27. She's been a syndicated television host, lead news anchor, and an Olympics reporter. As a documentarian, she's won 2 Emmy Awards, and she's reported worldwide from Brazil to Haiti to Pakistan. Our guest this week is Beth Troutman. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with a talk radio co-host of the WBT Charlotte Morning Show, Beth Troutman. Now, I noticed, looking over all of my materials, Beth, that there's a coincidence here. I think I've uncracked a code. I've noticed that WBT, which is one of those rare stations that goes back to the days where it only has 3 letters, WBT, and your co-host in the morning, Bo Thompson, and you're Beth Troutman, and the show is Good Morning, BT. Did you get the job because of your initials?
I hope it had a little more to do with it than that, but Bo and I have both marveled at the fact that what are the odds that we would be on a heritage station, and everyone here in town especially calls the station BT, mm-hmm. and Bo and I both have the initials BT, and our real names are, you know, Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman. These aren't, you know, made up on-air names.
Right.
So the odds that the fates would put us together are pretty remarkable that it worked out the way that it did, but I think that might have helped.
It's just one of those things that's remarkable, and
right.
I mean, did it like suddenly hit you guys, or was this something that had been done before? Because I love that kind of radio lore. There was once a time when DJs were hired, and they had to change their name to the name that they had jingles already prepared. So they just took over for the last guy, you know, with, yeah, you know, wild names. But I just find that to be just a great little piece of intrigue here. And, you know, like one day we're all sitting around going, hey, we're all BT. Or did it just happen organically?
Bo and I figured it out.
Uh-huh.
Bo and I recognized it. And when the head of our station group came to me and asked if I would, you know, come on as the co-host with Bo, I was the one that said, isn't it bizarre that both of our initials are BT? And it hit them in that moment that was the case. So I think Bo and I were the first ones to pick up on it.
Well, you know what they say? It's a sign. It's a sign.
Exactly.
You know, so, and obviously it was a good sign because I understand that you guys are doing very well. I know when Bo took over, he was sort of the news guy along with a high power personality. personality, an opinionated guy who happened to have been the former governor, and then he ascended into that chair. So what role do you play with him for the people listening around the country and around the world? What is the breakdown of the roles and the chemistry between the two of you in the morning?
Well, first of all, let me address the chemistry. I have worked in the media business for, you know, more than 20 years now, and I have never had instant chemistry with a co-host the way that Bo and I have that thing. It just clicked the first time we were ever on the air together. I was just coming in to fill in. Bo and I met back in 2016. I was working for NBC, and I was covering the Olympics down in Brazil, and Bo reached out to me randomly through Twitter. He messaged me. I always joke with him and say he slid into my DMs, but he messaged me on Twitter to see if I would do just a radio hit, because I was a local Charlottean who happened to be covering the Olympics, just to have a conversation on the air on what was then the Bo Thompson Show. And we had chemistry even then, even on the phone, and we became fast friends and stayed friends over the past several years. And when Governor McCrory decided to run for Senate and left the Pat McCrory Show that Bo was working on with him, Bo called me and just said, "Hey, could you come in and fill in every now and again?" And I said, "Absolutely, that would be so much fun." And first day we were on the air, he and I looked at each other and thought, man, there's something kind of crazy, like this lightning in a bottle kind of thing. So, you know, we approached the show, and this is what's remarkable about Bo. That show for 10 years has been the Bo Thompson Show. And when he and the station owners decided to bring me into the mix, it was Bo's idea, and Bo's idea to also change the name of the show and include my name, and it now became Good Morning BT with Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman. And we approached the show as, you know, true co-hosts and plan the show together and figure out where we're going to take the show together. And it's a true you know, match of equals in the best way. There's no ego. It is just this great friendship, great conversations, and we cover everything. And that's the really remarkable thing about it, is that we both love to talk politics. We love to talk pop culture. We'll talk entertainment. We'll talk local stories. And then we can also, you know, make fun of each other and have a really great time, which I think is important in this morning time slot, especially these days when there's so much negativity and so many news outlets that provide divisive commentary. We go the opposite direction and try to provide commentary that not only makes you think, but makes you feel good and makes you feel part of something and part of a family and makes you feel welcomed no matter what side of the aisle you fall on and no matter what your opinion. And Bo and I approach each other that way as well. And it really is quite a remarkable thing, because it doesn't, I've worked in the business long enough to know that this kind of thing just doesn't happen often. And when you find it, it's like finding a missing piece of the puzzle that has been just missing for years and years and years of your life, and then suddenly everything just fits.
That's wonderful to hear, and that you're right, that doesn't happen often. Sometimes teams that are put together by the bosses, you know, the corporate teams, well, here's your new co-host. Some of those are disastrous. Right. And even in cases where they're successful, you mentioned you became fast friends, even in cases where those kinds of teams are successful, I hear endless stories about how off the air they just don't get along, and it's a constant struggle. They even hate each other at sometimes. You know, when you have teams like Abbott and Costello, you look back to the great teams. We don't have that many comedic teams anymore, but you'd have, you know, Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, or in some cases you have rock bands. Going back, looking at the Beatles, you talk about chemistry. If any one guy left the Beatles, that would be the end of the Beatles. But even right, sometimes those kinds of groups break up because of egos and all of that. So this is just a wonderful thing to hear. Do you generally have, like, is he a yin and you're a yang? Is there any kind of, traditional differences between you that you play those roles either through happenstance or planning? Like, is he the conservative and you're the liberal? He's the guy and you're the gal? Because I have not heard the show yet, and I'm looking forward to. And I know that so many people listening to this haven't either. So how does that work?
Well, I definitely can't wait for you to listen to the show, and I can't wait for your listeners to also listen to the show. You know, we sometimes fall into the he's the guy, I'm the gal role with certain conversations, but there isn't really anything traditional about the roles that we have fallen into. We really do view each other as equals, and we both try to be incredibly respectful of not only each other's opinions and views. And, you know, sometimes I may fall left of center and he may fall right of center, but it's not planned. It just may be where we fall on a specific issue, and then vice versa. But most of the time we try to stay in a place that is informative more than anything, especially if we're dealing with political issues and news stories. But we rely on what our friendship and relationship is, and we really are on the air exactly who we are off the air, whether it be laughing or, you know, getting into a deep conversation. The respect that we have for each other just exists nonstop. So it has become that on the show, and I think we're doing something a little bit different, and I think it's why it's resonating with people, because we don't take stereotypic roles. You know, I'm not the giggle girl, although I do laugh a lot because that's just kind of my natural personality. But we can rib on each other in, you know, the same kind of ways. Neither one of us is the punching bag. It just really depends on where the story is and what the central meat of the story is as to where we fall in the conversation. But we do take really equal roles. And again, it's, I think, rare in the industry that you don't, and it's because we're not, our egos are so far removed from it because of who we are as people and who we are as friends, that I guess maybe that's why you don't hear more of that on the radio. Maybe it is that there's a level of competition going on between co-hosts, and Bo and I just don't have that. Our competition is all about, you know, putting on the best show and including our listeners as in the best possible way. So there is nothing traditional. I hope we're breaking the mold a bit, because I really don't think think there are other shows across the nation quite doing what we're doing. And I think that's what's really cool about it and really special about it.
Well, that sounds like the listeners are the beneficiaries of this, because in many cases, the mold should be broken. You take calls and have guests?
We sure do, every single day. Some days we'll not expect to have a call segment go for an hour and a half, but a topic may resonate with our listeners, and we love hearing from people, especially those new callers that are calling in, but we also have guests throughout the show. Our show is 4 hours long, so we really do run the gamut of all kinds of topics. You know, yesterday we had a local Charlottean who was born in Pakistan and who is helping raise money for the Pakistan floods that have happened in the last month, and, you know, had this really remarkable interview about a place on the other side of the world that a lot of people don't have a connection to. And we were able to talk to someone locally who is connected to a lot of people in that country. And then we, you know, have people who are promoting blood drives. We have local politicians. We have national politicians. Every Monday on our show, Mick Mulvaney, the former White House Chief of Staff under President Trump, comes on our show for an hour to break down what's happening in Washington. And it's quite a remarkable conversation.
Well, you know, you mentioned before that you're not, you know, the traditional, you use the term giggle gal or giggle girl. And those of us in radio understand what that is, but you are not opposed to laughing and giggling if it's natural. I just want to point out that you certainly are no giggle girl, and I'm assuming people understand what we're talking about within the context of a traditional radio show. I mean, you've got a heavyweight background in terms of the things that you've done. You've worked on the production team for The West Wing. You even ran for Congress at the age of 27, which I want to ask you some questions about that. You are a former television host. You worked for NBC. You covered the Olympics. You've made documentaries. You won a couple of Emmy Awards. You've reported around the world. I mean, you know, you have the you're entitled to giggle if you want to, because.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a huge compliment.
You know, so tell us about your experience. Well, which jumps into your mind most? These two very interesting things you've done. One, having been part of the production team for The West Wing, because a lot of people think that The West Wing was real. that was real, you know. And I did for a while. You get so into those kinds of shows.
Well, I think there were a lot of people who wished it were real, right?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And then you ran for, did you run for Congress after The West Wing or before The West? How did those two play together? And then tell us a bit about each.
I will tell you that The West Wing was my first job out of college. Now, I actually... I majored in political science and women's studies, of all things, which terrified my parents because they thought I would never get a job. But I had this goal in mind at 22 that I wanted to change Hollywood because I thought that would change the images of women on television and how that affected the self-esteem and, you know, how women perceive themselves. And The West Wing finished its first season in my last semester at UNC Chapel Hill. And I thought, man, I need to learn from them. These people are brilliant writers. They have strong female characters that don't have the traditional look that we have seen across the television spectrum for years and years. So I'm going to work there. And I packed up a U-Haul, and I drove across the country before I even applied for a job. I'm not quite sure what gave me the confidence to do that or why I wasn't smart enough to apply first, but I made it to Los Angeles. I checked into a hotel called the Hollywood Ramada Inn, which I do not recommend to anyone. It may not be there anymore. And bought a fax machine, which tells you what year this was, at Staples. And I cold called the West Wing and asked them if they were looking for production assistance. And the guy who answered the phone said, just fax a resume to this person at this number, and basically hung up. And I thought, well, you know, it's worth a try. I faxed my resume, and the woman who was hiring happened to be standing at the fax machine when my resume came through, and she called me 2 hours later. And I went in the next day for an interview, and I started the next week on the show as a production assistant, which leads me to my advice that I give to people all the time is never have a plan B. Because you will use it. And if you have just, if you stick to that plan A, you're going to make it work. Because I feel like that must have been what was going on. And I started, you know, the bottom rung of production, which is a production assistant does whatever anyone asks them to do. I did paperwork. I got coffee. I ran errands. I worked 21-hour days. And in that last, at the end of that first season, my first season on the show was season 2 of the show, when we found the answer, if anybody's a fan of the show, to who's been hit, you know, which was the big cliffhanger at the end of season 1. And I found out that a director that I that had been a guest director on our show was coming on as a staff director and a producer. And so I cold called him and just asked if I could be his assistant because I wanted to learn from him. And again, he just said, well, fax me your resume. And I did, and he hired me as his assistant. And so for the next 3 years, I worked as his right-hand man, which meant that I got to spend time in the writer's room, and I was on set with him as he was blocking scenes, and I was on set while he was filming, and then I'd be in the editing room as we were putting the show together. So it was like getting a master's degree in television production. And it was an unbelievable education. And I mean, a ton of hard work, but so much fun. That group of people, that was another lightning in a bottle situation. Just brilliant writers, a fantastic crew behind the scenes, just incredible actors who were in front of the camera, who really could deliver Aaron Sorkin dialogue. And all of it together was just a remarkable experience. And at the end of my fourth year on the show, I actually ended up getting a cold call from Washington, D.C., asking if I would be interested in running for the U.S. House of Representatives. And I thought it was a joke, and I hung up. I just hung up the phone, the guy called back and said, here, let me give you my number. Call me back, but this is not a joke. And I did call, and it was real. They were asking if I would run for the U.S. House back in my home state of North Carolina. I went to one of the producers on the show because I was so dumbfounded by the call. I had thought about a career in politics much later in life, but not, you know, at 27, and certainly not running for a federal office at 27. But the producer that I went to talk to, a person I trusted, said, Beth, you know, people don't get these phone calls. So even if you get 5 votes, absolutely you should do it, because you will have run a congressional campaign at the age of 27. And so I called back and I said, all right, I will throw my hat in the ring. And while I was making that call, this producer went down to the set to tell everyone that this had just happened. I got down to the set, and Bradley Whitford, who played Josh on the show, wrote me a check for $1,500 made out to Beth Troutman for Congress, which that was the amount that I needed to file to run. And I had to call my committee, Beth Troutman for Congress, so that I could cash Bradley Whitford's check. And they were, the whole cast, the crew, the producers, everybody was so incredibly supportive. Martin Sheen even came and campaigned with me for 3 days on the road. And to your point that people thought it was real, most people did call him President Bartlett while we were on the campaign trail together.
That's amazing. Now, I, you know, with all due respect, why did, I guess this person that called you was a well-connected political person.
Yes.
And why you? I mean, was it one of those quixotic races where you would have no chance whatsoever, and they couldn't find anybody, and they wound up with you for some reason? I mean,
felt that way while I was campaigning part of the time. Now, I worked for the Speaker of the North Carolina House while I was in college. I interned for him, and my father and grandfather were both politically active in Cabarrus County, the area where I grew up, and they initially reached out to my dad, and my dad made a joke in passing. Yeah, he turned it down and said, no, like, why would anybody vote for me? I'm exactly the same guy who is running, who is the incumbent. We're both, you know, 60-something white men from the same hometown. My daughter would be so much better at this. And didn't really realize that he was actually giving this guy an idea, and there it was. You know, that was the idea. And it, ironically, I was running against an incumbent whose son I dated in high school.
Talk about a small town. I mean, but this was a congressional district. What party did you get the nomination?
I ran as a Democrat in 2004, and was up against a very popular incumbent who had also run for governor of the state at one point. And I also campaigned for him when he ran for governor back in 1996 because I knew him incredibly well. So when I threw my hat into the ring and when I won my primary, I was the first woman to ever run in this district. It was District 8 at the time. It was 10 counties across the state of North Carolina. That was quite an interesting district because it had Charlotte-Mecklenburg, which is the wealthiest city in North Carolina, in Mecklenburg County, one of the wealthiest counties. And then it went all the way over to Fayetteville and included Anson County, which was one of the more rural counties in North Carolina. And then I had a military base as well. So it was this really fascinating district. And I ended up at the end of the race, I ended up with 45% of the vote.
Oh my. That's fantastic. So obviously the victory of the primary and getting the nomination had to be exhilarating. Were you deflated? How did it feel to lose the general election?
Well, when the numbers first started coming in, the first county to report was Mecklenburg County, and I won that county with around 60% of the vote. And so I was winning when those first numbers came through on CNN, which I about fainted when I saw that coming through because I knew that I put up a good fight, but I raised about $250,000 to my opponent's $1.8 million in the campaign against me. So monetarily, we had a very different race. So I wasn't expecting to win. So I was shocked when my numbers came in and I was winning in the beginning. I was a bit deflated because I was 27 and so idealistic, and I really had this Mr. Smith goes to Washington view. I really wanted to shake up Washington. I really wanted to go make a change. I really wanted to be the youngest woman to ever be in Washington and really fight the fight, because I didn't have the thirst for power or the thirst for I didn't have even then my ego wasn't involved in what I was doing. I really just wanted to make a difference and to make a change. So that part of it, not getting to do that, was a bit deflating. But I will tell you that what I had seen on the news all of those years before, when I had watched people's election parties, you know, what they don't tell you is when you start losing, people start leaving.
So by the time
I was done with my, when I knew for sure that I was going to concede and I made the concession call to my opponent, I got up to make my concession speech, and the literal words that came out of my mouth were, "Mom, Dad, thanks for the support," because they were the only ones there.
It's always depressing, you know, at the losing headquarters where the balloons are deflated and the people are leaving, and there's always the diehards that are all crushed around the podium, so it looks like there's a crowd for the news cameras and all that. What did you learn having that experience about politics that you could now bring to the microphone several years later, you've been on TV and you've been a reporter and you've done documentaries, but that campaign, on the heels of having worked on an amazing political television show where I'm sure there was a lot of discussion about politics in the hallways, what did you learn from that you bring to the table today in this latest incarnation of you?
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest lessons I learned was how to communicate an idea, how to communicate in a way that resonates with people, but also the importance of listening. When you're campaigning, and especially because I was young and my learning curve was so steep, I had to pay a lot of attention to what people who had done this before were trying to teach me and trying to tell me, but also I really, really wanted to hear from the people who lived in my district who I was hoping to represent, and to learn to understand their issues and their problems, and to look at people with empathy and look at their lives through a lens of kindness and try to figure out the best way to include the most people in a solution to problems, because our country throughout generations has faced its own challenges. And at that time, we were dealing with the war in Iraq having just started. We were dealing with the idea of a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. There were those issues that people were really, really concerned about. And we were also in that moment in history when industry was starting to leave U.S. soil and you know, go other places, especially manufacturing jobs, which was a big deal here in North Carolina because we had so many manufacturing jobs that were leaving, especially those more rural cities. So learning how to understand issues that I didn't have a personal connection to at the time because I was so young and I had worked for a TV show. You know, I didn't come from a manufacturing background, and to learn from these people and to listen and to have a heart and really care for people. But, you know, also I had to learn what it meant to find my own voice, because as I was listening to people who had run for office before or to consultants who were trying to tell me what to do, I realized that one of the best things that I could have done, and I didn't do well, in fact, when I ran, is to listen to my gut a little more and to trust my instincts a little more when it came to representing myself in the best way possible. I did allow consultants because I thought that maybe they did know better. I let them guide me a little more than I wish that I would have, because there were definitely things I would have done differently. So I think I learned that fine balance of diplomacy, where you learn to listen and learn how to communicate, but also learn how to respect your own moral compass and your own, ethics center. And that has served me well throughout, especially a journalism career and learning how to tell stories. One of the keys to being a great storyteller is listening. You know, the story, being a journalist and being a news anchor and being a documentarian, it's never about me. It's about the story I'm telling. It's about the person that is in front of me trying to share their human experience. And when you are able to get out of your own way and really listen, that's when you find the meat of the story, when you really can connect with someone through kindness or through empathy and get their story, because they trust you to tell the story with honesty and tell the story ethically and tell the story in the best way, in the most truthful way possible. And I think maybe that's something that is missing right now in some levels of journalism, and in the ways that we now have echo chambers that just echo what we already believe, in the ways that we can, you know, tune into networks that just say what we already think, rather than challenging us to see the truth or challenging us to understand all sides of a story. And I think by running for office, I was capable of learning how to see all sides of an issue and respect all sides of an issue, because if you're going to be an effective politician, you have to understand, or you should want to understand, everyone's side and find the best solution.
One of the things that we observe today in terms of the way the world is, the world of media, the world of politics, which are, of course, so closely tied together, is that we're in an era of targeting audiences as opposed to finding your voice and presenting your view or presenting the view of others as a journalist. And you just shared with us a little bit of your view of the state of journalism. This targeting of audiences has created a situation whereby, especially in news talk radio, many of the stations that do news talk commercially today find themselves dealing with a conservative audience, and most of the programming is conservative. And from my observations, those that try to expand the boundaries or to show the other side of Trumpism, and other options, are often attacked by the listeners, by the core audiences, as being a rhino or being a pinko or being a socialist. And as a result, a lot of talk show hosts find themselves forced to direct their comments to the core, to give, I call it the daily dance of affirmation, telling people what they already want to hear. It sounds to me like you and Bo have something very different going on. And yet I do know there's a very strong conservative element in Charlotte and in North Carolina. WBT is more than just Charlotte. It's a regional station. And you obviously have a conservative leaning audience. Do you deal with that problem of having to defend yourself to listeners from maybe not having the exact point of view on specific issues that they want you to have?
There's definitely some communication every now and again, especially if I ask a pointed question about a specific political issue or I push someone on a topic to get an answer. But my approach to people is, again, through a lens of kindness and never through a lens of attack, whether it be attacking Trumpism or attacking rhinos or attacking Democrats. My method of talking is never about attacking a specific viewpoint. My method is find truth and also to offer validation to the way that people feel and think. And I think if we all spent time kind of getting back to that method of conversation, that if someone disagrees with you, that doesn't make them a bad person and it doesn't make them your enemy. It doesn't make them it doesn't make them someone to shut down or to ignore. I think it's exactly the opposite. And this has been one of the great challenges and one of the great lessons in working at this station and working on this show is really understanding that aspect about the three-dimensionality of people. There are people who are loyal listeners who may not always agree with me now or agree with my line of questioning, but 100% I think they know that I am coming from a place of looking for truth, looking for the story, and also looking to respect other people's viewpoints and offer a level of empathy and a level of kindness. I'm never going to be the person that tries to shut anyone down. And usually, and I found this to be true when I was working in news as well, usually when people do reach out with some kind of negative comment or anything that might be cruel or even a personal attack at me, I always respond, and I respond by acknowledging their comment and then offer gratitude for them feeling that they can share their comment with me, and that I hope that I can change the way that they're feeling about me if they're not seeing me as someone that they can trust. And 99% of the time, those people do come back with something positive and do tend to end up being loyal listeners and do end up generating effective conversation. And so that's, I think, been the challenge and the really fun part, is because we try to stay in a place that is factual and in a place that is interesting for our listeners, and then also offer a platform for people of differing views to come on and share their views and not feel like they're going to be attacked and not feel like they're going to be that their opinion isn't valid. And I hope that more people start doing maybe more of that, because I think it's more what we need in our society, is this really healthy, robust conversations that are full of different viewpoints. We shouldn't look at people as enemies. We should be looking at each other as humans who are going through what is a really tough life. Life's tough for everybody. And if we can offer each other support and kindness and an ear, then I think we're doing our jobs.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with Beth Troutman, a dynamic rising star of radio who co-hosts The Morning Show with Bo Thompson on Heritage Radio Station WBT in Charlotte. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it, as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Wrap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a production of Good Phone Communications, presented in association with Podcast One and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.